This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest, Kevin Costner, has been one of the most recognized faces in Hollywood for 20 years, emerging as a leading man from films like No Way Out, The Untouchables, and Bull Durham, then directing and starring in Dances with Wolves, which won 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Director. Among his other films are Field of Dreams, JFK, Waterworld, 10 Cup, 13 Days, and The Upside of Anger. Costner's newest role is a dark one in the film Mr. Brooks. He plays Earl Brooks, a successful business owner and family man who has a secret life as a serial killer. The film is about his struggle with an addiction to the thrill of murder, and he frequently argues with his evil alter ego, Marshall, played by William Hurt. In this scene, Mr. Brooks is at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting where he doesn't reveal the nature of his addiction, and he's challenged by his dark side, Marshall.
Hi, my name's Earl, and I'm an addict. Anyone else?
If you were honest, you'd step up there and say, "Hi, I'm Earl. I killed 2 people last night. I really got off on it, but I need your help to be cured."
I'm different, Marshall. I won't argue that with you. But this is the only place that has ever helped me be normal, and I have been straight up until last night, for the past 2 years. I'm not going to kill again. And I am not going to quit coming here because it upsets you.
Well, Kevin Costner, welcome to Fresh Air. This new film you're in, Mr. Brooks, you know, I haven't seen all of your movies, but I can't remember you playing anybody as creepy as this.
Right.
Describe your character, Earl Brooks, and what appealed to you about this role.
Well, I have played characters that had some sinister sides in Perfect World and 3,000 Miles to Graceland, and one might argue that Wyatt Earp had some killer in him. But yeah, I think I know where you're going with this. As for describing my part, you know, why I wanted to do it, I actually don't go about it that way. I have to make sure I enjoy the script first. If I make the determination, I think, yeah, this has a playability, either a wide audience or a narrow one, but it must have an audience. And so when I read that, I was attracted first to how the screenplay read, all the parts included. And at that point, knowing that I thought this was a good movie, I felt that it had a chance to be a classic. Once I made that determination, and I had to figure out if there was a part in there that I thought that I could play. And Earl Brooks, I saw it. I understood the darkness. I also understood the empathy that might be evoked.
How did you figure out how to play a serial killer, and as you say, in this case, one who's a very empathetic character in parts of his life?
Yeah, it almost does a disservice to just start off with serial killer, because immediately you're just going to eliminate a certain part of the audience, probably including me, that says, "Gee, I just don't want to go see a movie about that. Sorry, I like you very much, but thanks, but no thanks." I don't like serial killer movies. I don't like finding myself in a room with blood on the walls or, you know, too much silence. I don't like scary movies. You know, I don't like the haunted house situations. They genuinely, I guess, scare me. Hate to admit that, since I play a lot of superheroes. But in terms of how I played it, I obviously had all the research at the tip of my fingers. Unfortunately, that's the condition of our society, that we have these people all around us now, and there's probably not a channel, not an hour in the day that you can't find some channel devoted to this horrific situation that we see played out almost daily and weekly.
One of the things that William Hurt said in the production notes was that interplay between you and he reminded him of mirror exercises. What does he mean?
Well, you know, one of the things that I think we both really loved is, you know, we've had these careers where now we're kind of known around the world and among our own colleagues. But I think sometimes it's so fun to look back at your journey and how, before anyone knew you, you know, you look fondly back at class and the exercises that you performed and how you, you know, mimic each other. And there's 100 games you play as an actor. And I think those that love acting the most love all the games. And William's talking about exercises that one does in mimicking each other and voice quality and kind of value for value acting, whether it's voice or a physical movement.
Oh, so that's what, you're not standing in front of a mirror, you're standing in front of another actor mimicking each other.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're and again, we're playing the same guy. It just, it forced us to go into our bag of tricks.
I want to talk a little bit about your career. You grew up in California. From what I gather, a more or less normal existence to the extent anybody has one, played sports in high school. And what was the impulse that pushed you into performing, into acting?
Well, I really, I was born in Compton, lived for 7-8 years, and then kind of moved around a lot, went to 4 different high schools. But I really had a very normal childhood. I mean, we weren't poor, but we weren't rich. I just, it was only when I started seeing other people's backyard did I understand that we didn't have some of that stuff. But it was a childhood I wouldn't have traded. My upbringing was incredibly conservative, but has served me well. There are moments when I had to break out of that, and clearly the choice to become an actor was one of those. I needed to kind of get out of this maze of, what was a young man supposed to do? You're supposed to go to college, go to business, get a job and work. But something inherently in me was a voice that was coming out saying, man, you've got to find out really what you need to be about. I mean, and when I started to contemplate acting, because I always knew that I was performance oriented, the voice kept coming back. Yeah, you're just trying to postpone going out there into the real world and working. You know, I mean,
are we talking about college or after college, or
we're talking about during college? Uh-huh. Because I could tell that I was not equipped. I mean, I know what a good student is. I think probably one of my strengths, if I have any, is the recognition of who is kind of good at what they do. And I've never been intimidated by, you know, knowing that I wasn't the guy. I was just encouraged knowing that the guy we needed in the right spot was in the room, or we better go find him because we don't have the right guy. And if I would assess myself, I was not an academic. And so I wasn't going to do well in school, and I could see that. And when I finally did stumble on to acting late at night one night in an accounting class where I was on the left side of the bell curve all the way to the end, I read about a play in the student newspaper, Rumpelstiltskin, and if I had to tell it would have started wagging. I immediately started to get interested. Oh, I mean, tomorrow I can, at 12 o'clock, I can go for an audition somewhere. I was clearly excited about 12 o'clock the next day and had no interest in what was happening at that very moment with a professor who was talking about accounting. But I was excited about that possibility, and I decided to chase that. And I obviously didn't get the audition, but from there I realized that they were providing classes one night a week. So I started to go one night a week, and one night a week turned into 5 nights a week, and I found it.
You know, there's a story. Sometimes these get mangled in the telling that an encounter with Richard Burton drove you to acting seriously. Is that right?
It did. It was a significant moment. Make no mistake. I think that's why it's lived a little bit in the consciousness of people. I did see him on a plane, and it was right around the time when I was saying, I was already taking his classes, and I was thinking, do I want to do this? And I desperately wanted to talk to him, and he had bought all the seats around him on the plane so that no one could talk to him. clearly everybody was watching him, and I was watching him. But at one moment, I just felt so compelled to go up to him, and his reaction could have been 100 different things to me, but it was incredibly generous. I think he was reading Gore Vidal's Lincoln at that moment, and he said, "Well, yes, I will answer a question when I'm done reading," or something like that. So I literally watched him for the next hour, and when he finally put the book down, I thought it was my moment. And then he leaned his seat back and went to sleep, and I thought, he's forgotten about me. And he took a little cat nap in about 15 minutes. He kind of woke up and looked back at me, and he kind of waved me up. And what we talked about was very sweet. And I asked him a couple questions, which to this day I wish that we could have circled back to each other to talk about. But it was significant, but how important, I don't know. I just saw him, and I thought, this is what I want to do.
Well, you got into acting, and I know that Lawrence Kasdan cast you for a role in The Big Chill, which is the answer to a trivia question. You're the guy at the beginning of the movie who's the cadaver who's being dressed for the funeral.
What's that worth now in Trivial Pursuits? Is it 50 points or what?
And then you're in Silverado, that great sweeping Western that he makes. And you had a string of really successful films early. I mean, No Way Out, where you played the Navy ensign, and The Untouchables.
Right.
And then kind of that enduring favorite, Bull Durham. You know, this has taken you back 20 years now, I know, but those of us who still love and admire that movie just continue to quote it at ball games and all. Does it hold a special place in your heart, too?
Well, it does. I Field of Dreams, Bull Durham, those movies, for that matter, Love of the Game, those three particular movies are, I guess, represent my franchise. They're my sequels, I guess. But
Custer Baseball Collection. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess they are. You know, they're really standalone movies, and I've the architecture of my career has been the standalone movie for the most part, and those movies were absolutely individual, yet you know, circled the same subject.
Well, let's hear a clip from Bull Durham. This is you, of course, play Crash Davis, who is a veteran catcher with almost enough talent to make the big leagues, but basically has spent a career in the minor leagues. And in this film, he's at the Durham Bulls, and his job is to groom a young pitching talent, Nuke LaLouche, and you dispense advice. This is late in the film where Nuke has finally gotten called up to the big leagues. You're kind of feeling down about your own career, but you sit and give him a last piece of advice. Let's listen.
Look, Nuke, these big league hitters are going to light you up like a pinball machine for a while, right? Don't worry about it. You be cocky and arrogant, even when you're getting beat. It's a secret. You got to play this game with fear and arrogance.
Fear and ignorance.
No. Fear and arrogance. All right, you hayseed, not ignorance.
No, I know. I just like seeing you get all worked up.
And that's Tim Robbins and my guest Kevin Costner from the classic Bull Durham. It's one of my favorite films, and you seem to just perfectly embody the swagger of a ball player. Where did that come from? Do you have a history with baseball before that?
Yeah, I played it early in my life, and it's really a game that I always felt like I understood, and played it in the street, played it on an organized level, and a lot of people dream about being able to play professional baseball, and you could put me in that same same category, and I've been able to now play it. I've been able to pitch a perfect game in Yankee Stadium with Vin Scully announcing it. So it's
right. That was the film for The Love of the Game.
Yeah, it's been a really good ride for where that's been concerned.
Did you do anything in particular for that film to get a feel for the culture of pro ball players? What the dugout, what the clubhouse is like?
No, I did my research, but I've had it, and it is I've seen that thing that was described, athletic arrogance. I've seen it all. So it was not one that was a foreign. If I would not, for instance, play a hockey movie, I would let someone else do that because I don't know the nuance of it. I can't skate, but I was very confident about Bull Durham and in this minor league situation about what was happening, and I had this perfect roadmap.
Well, we should talk about Dances with Wolves, which is just looms large in your career. This was a Michael Blake novel adapted for the screen. And I read that – now, this was – you directed this film and, of course, won the Oscar for Best Director. It also won Best Picture and five other awards that year. But I read that you actually envisioned someone else directing it, right?
I did. I initially asked two very prominent directors. I won't name them. And both of them saw flaws in the script. I don't think they saw them as – they might have saw them as flaws in the script, but they recognized the conventions of modern-day filmmaking. And the first one identified that he felt that that maybe the Civil War sequence, because I told them that the movie was long, and as they looked at it, they immediately thought that maybe we didn't need the opening Civil War sequence. It took up about 15 or 20 minutes where, you know, it established it kind of who he was. And I saw, and you could see that that was a natural cut in a film, but I thought, no, I don't want to do that. And then the other one suggested that maybe the Mary McDonald character should be, you know, a Native American woman, that her being a white captive was maybe a bit cliche. And I thought, no, I mean, I can understand why they might think that, but that if you know anything about the American frontier, white captives were, was a way of life. It was a way of commerce. It just is what happened when you had this migratory march across this continent without any kind of military being around. It was, a lot of people think of it in a sense of, about Indians, about movie, about Native Americans. And I take, I'm happy that they think that, but it really was a white man's story who ventured in.
Well, let's hear a cut from Dances with Wolves. This is a moment well into the film where you, as Lieutenant Dunbar, have settled with this Lakota Sioux tribe, and they are going off to fight a war. You wanted to be involved, but Kicking Bird, who was the one of the men that you've come to deal with, has said, no, you should stay behind. And this scene is translated through the Merritt McDonald character, whose name is Stands With Fist, I think.
Yes.
So let's listen to this cut from Dances with Wolves.
Tiwahi mitawa kile awanka okihi sechalo.
He also asked that you watch over his family while he is gone. This thing he asks is a great honor for you.
Tell him that I would be happy to watch over his family.
Huh, okihi kea. He thanks Dances with Wolves for coming.
Who's Dances with Wolves?
It is the name which all the people are calling you now.
And that's from Dances with Wolves, directed by our guest Kevin Costner. One of the things that was interesting about this film was that so much of the film is actually in subtitles with the Indian character speaking the Lakota Sioux
right.
language. And
right.
I imagine that might not have been so easy for a studio to digest. Talk a little bit about how you decided to use the Lakota language and, you know, mechanically. I mean, not that many people speak it. You had
right.
to learn some of
well,
it.
Well, as we took the movie around, it was passed on a, you know, we did the whole circuit through town and it was passed on. I was on my second lap and literally at the last studio, and the comment that came back was, Kev, we understand what you're talking about. We understand that you want to make this movie long, but the thing that is bothering us is the subtitles. We're just not sure that it's going to fly. I thought, you know, it's so funny because I think that's what makes the movie is the sense of humor, the sense of kind of what really caused so much conflict on the frontier was our inability to communicate. And that was kind of the pivot point for me on this movie, that these people who desperately should be talking to each other, want to talk to each other, couldn't. And this simple language allowed fear and everything to slide in. And so I looked at everybody in the meeting. I go, you know, it has to, no, the subtitles have to be there. And at that point, they really couldn't make the movie. And I decided to throw a last chip into the pot, if you will. And I said, by the way, I also want to have final cut on it. I remember as I left the room, my partner, as we shut the door, he pulled me right against the wall, just literally, you know, just outside the door, and goes, what was that about? I said, what about? He says, the final cut, what was that about? Why'd you have to throw that in? And I said, well, Jimmy, you know, it just dawned on me that if people don't understand completely about how the movie is, how can we also put somebody in the position of cutting this movie? It was kind of a bold move, but it kind of almost like becoming an actor. A lot of things just became clear.
The stories about Kevin Costner's career always talk about, you know, there was the enormous success with Dances with Wolves, and then there's what's called The Slump. You know, Waterworld, most expensive film ever made at that time. You know, mixed reviews, and then Postman, not so good reviews. How do you look at that period? I mean, do you see it as a slump?
Well, I think if you look at things empirically, if you want to look at things empirically and talk about money, then Waterworld certainly paid for itself multiple times. It's very difficult to get anybody to write that, but that was a very financially successful movie, and a movie that's kind of loved around the world. People are almost ashamed to say, I get it all the time. Hey, Kev, by the way, I liked Waterworld. Uh-huh. It was flawed, as are all movies that I've been a part of, and it has its flaws. But I understand kind of what you're asking. I've just always kind of put my stock in the individual movie, and I go forward. I like The Postman, but I can't, sit and try to convince someone else to like it. I liked it. That's why I did it. And I don't like turning my back on my work. And but I certainly should allow other people their opinion about it.
I thought we'd talk about another one of your more recent films, The Upside of Anger, in where you play a retired ball player who lives next door to a woman, Terry, played by Joan Allen, whose husband has apparently taken off with another woman to Sweden. And your character, Denny Davies, the retired ball player,
right,
has kind of develops a drinking relationship. And I wanted to play this clip. This is after the two of you have finally gotten close enough to have intimacy, and this is the immediate aftermath.
Right.
Oh, God. Now, that was a real misstep.
Oh, that was a sweet thing to say.
God, what am I doing? Why am I here?
You're here because you're sad and lonely. Desperate. You need someone, something. Anything to fill you, any port in a storm.
I asked why I was here, not you. What's my story?
And that's Joan Allen and my guest Kevin Costner in the film The Upside of Anger. That's a film where you could be seen as sort of playing an aging Crash Davis. Did you actually deliberately gain weight for that role?
Yeah. Well, I think that people, it's so funny out there. There's this weird thing where half the world doesn't want people to work out because we go, gee, most of us don't look like that. Why would you look like that, all buffed out, look like you'd just come out of prison or something, we want you to be just like us. And then when you actually, somebody like myself that has played, let's say, traditional leads in American film, comes out with a pot belly, it's amazing how critically people come after that and don't tie that necessarily to a character choice. It's funny, but yeah, I let him be soft. Clearly, he's gone. I mean, he was an athlete that went to the highest level, and he's not doing that now. He's signing autographs at shows for guys that he doesn't want to be around. So I thought that's just a choice.
How did you gain the weight and lose it?
Well, when I want to lose weight, I just quit drinking milk because I'm a milk drinker. I mean, I've never done one of those commercials, but that's all I do is drink milk. So when I'm drinking milk, everything that goes with it, apple pie, all this stuff late at night, everything heated, I heat Twinkies, man, for crying out loud, just so they just seem really great, and then there goes the milk. So if I want to lose weight, I just quit drinking milk.
All right, diet tip for those of you out there who want to hear something.
It's that scientific.
You recently directed and starred in Open Range, a Western with Robert Duvall. I mean, this is, you've done Westerns a fair amount over your career. I'm thinking back to Silverado, which was, you were very young and a different kind of cowboy.
Right.
What do you love about this genre?
I think it's our Shakespeare, and I think they're number one, very difficult to make. They're not easy. They're a lot more sophisticated than just yep and nope. And there's the black hat and the white hat, but how you get to those is if you actually really try to understand the time that people were having to live by their wits back then. It's not frontier land like in Disneyland. It's, sometimes the West has become mythical, but it was a very real place 150 years ago where people were living and dying based on decisions, based on going left and right. And I think when you treat the Western that way, you have a chance to make, a movie that can relate to a contemporary audience. But you don't have to kowtow to them by trying to make everything modern. If you just exist in the moment, That's why I say it's Shakespeare. You will begin to understand. I don't completely understand Shakespeare, but when I see it performed beautifully, I suddenly, 10 minutes in, begin to understand everything that's said, every nuance that's there. And the West is the same thing. I think you find the Victorian language that was going on there, that the simplicity of what one man would say to another when he wanted him to get his message. And pretty soon, you don't have to be just an American to understand that what he said was really serious.
Well, Kevin Costner, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Kevin Costner, he stars in the new film, Mr. Brooks.